This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is traveling this week. Coming up, Black community reaction to President Obama's cuts to Social Security. A former investigator for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says the agency is running a con game. And parents boycott high-stakes testing in New York City schools. But first, the Chicago Teachers Union is preparing for a political showdown with Mayor Rahm Emanuel, whose hand-picked school's chief is forcing the closure of 54 public schools, almost all of them serving Black and Brown students. Michael Brunson is the union's recording secretary. He says Chicago is ground zero in the fight to preserve public education.
These school closings are going on across the nation in major urban cities like Detroit, D.C., I believe Cleveland's on the list, Philadelphia. But by far, Chicago has the largest number now. We're talking about 54 schools being closed, but at the same time, we have six other schools that are being turned around and charter schools being co-located in some of our schools also.
And your union stands out in resistance to these closures.
Yes, we do. First of all, our administration, before we even came into office, we were out there leading the charge on fighting school turnarounds and closures. You know, this whole so-called school reform movement that is pretty much an attempt to privatize our public education system and diminish the ranks of experienced and teachers and a diverse teaching population.
All along, the effort has been to drive a wedge between teachers' unions and the community, but they haven't been successful in Chicago.
No, and once again, it goes back to this administration's background. I said we were fighting the school reform movement before we came into office, but we were also out working in the community, working with community groups and fighting for educational justice and social justice. So many of our leadership and many in our administration, we have grassroots organizing backgrounds and social activist backgrounds. We are very much in tune with the community.
One of the ways you're resisting is a planned voter registration drive. The goal is to add 100,000 new voters. That would be, if you meet that goal, the biggest voter registration campaign in Illinois since 92, I believe.
The main problem that we have here is that we have a school board that is not elected. It is appointed by the mayor. Chicago is under mayoral control. It has been under mayoral control since 1995, and that is the main thing that has put Chicago in the forefront of this so-called school reform movement. There is a growing movement within this city, not just within the Chicago Teachers Union, but coming from the public also, that people are now demanding an elected representative school board that actually does represent the interest of the public, of our students, and of the parents.
So what we're seeing here is not just a fight over the schools, but a fight for democratization of the whole process.
We all care deeply about our children. And one thing about what's going on right now is when you look at where the majority of these school closings are taking place, they're taking place in African-American communities. And the school is one of the things that keeps the community stable. So by closing down these schools, it not only places our children in jeopardy, because first of all, anyone that knows about Chicago knows that we have a horrendous gang problem in this city. Not only is there a problem with the gangs, we have neighborhoods that don't get along. So when CPS is asking parents to send their children over to another neighborhood just to go to school every day, they are definitely placing those children in jeopardy. And that's one of the main things that has the parents and the community upset here. And when you close these schools also, you have to think of the fact that it has an impact on the community. You close the school, people don't want to move into this community if they do not have a school that they can send their children to. And if people are not moving into the community, you don't need more businesses in that community to serve them. And it just is part of a downward spiral that pretty much disinvests from our community and causes them to crumble.
So we're not talking about just a destabilization of the educational process, but a destabilization of the community.
Exactly. This is another part of destabilizing the communities in these urban areas. We've made that connection, and people see that connection.
The head of the Chicago Public Schools claims that there's nothing racist about these closing, no racial aspect at all.
She's the one leading the charge. I'm sure she wants to make things look as though they're for the benefit of everyone, but you have to look at the fact that this has a disparate impact on the black communities. I read some report somewhere where one out of four African-American students in Chicago will be affected by these oncoming closings and turnarounds and co-locations. They all come under the rubric of school actions. So, yes, it has a disparate effect upon our community. It also has a disparate effect upon African-American teachers because a lot of these teachers that are in these areas are veteran African-American teachers, and they will also be disparately impacted by these closings because a number of jobs are going to be lost because of this.
This could be a make-or-break issue for the teachers' union, but could it also be a make-or-break issue for the mayor?
Hence the political campaign. People are getting fed up. We have a mayor that's come into office. One of the first things that he did was he went after the mental health clinics and started shutting them down. He went after the libraries, public libraries. He went after some of the custodial jobs. He's had an impact, a very negative impact upon our community. So this is one of a series of just bad actions that do not work towards his credit.
Race to the top has been described by some as race to the bottom. What do you think?
I would have to agree with that. Race to the top is based upon competition. And when you talk about competing for funds and resources, you're not starting with an even playing field to begin with. Automatically, you have some schools that have a leg up over others, the ones that really need the resources. If you're going to go by test scores and things like that, they are not going to be able to compete fairly. And if the money is going to follow those that won the competition, then you can see who's going to be adversely affected by this competitive model. We just do not agree that educational funding should be placed upon a competitive model.
What are the indications that other teachers' unions in other cities will follow your lead in this kind of resistance?
Well, you know, one thing that's interesting is we had a historic strike. We had a lot of good things, progressive things that happened with our contract negotiations. And after all of that, you know, we were getting calls from literally from all over the nation, other unions wanting us to come in and talk to them, let us know how we did it. People, I would say all across this nation, are fed up with this so-called school reform movement. And it's starting to really show its ugly head as being really nothing more than a way to privatize our public school systems. So we here are in Chicago are providing a pushback and a pushback model for fighting this thing. And we have to fight this. We have to preserve our public education system because without public education, you really cannot have a democracy in this country. This is really, really tragic because from my perspective, this goes beyond just public education. There seems to be a movement afoot in this nation that's really negatively impacting not just teachers, but a number of public workers. And of course, in order to go after the public workers and caretakers, you have to go after those that defend them. So they're doing things that put the unions in the bad light and try to crush us. And this may be a step in that battle also. You can look at it like that. And what's unfortunate is the collateral damage. If you're going to do something like that, why are you using our children as collateral damage in a battle that you want to wage against those who protect our caretakers in this country?
Michael Brunson of the Chicago Teachers Union. Parents at 33 New York City public schools are saying no to high-stakes testing. The boycott was organized by a group called Time Out from Testing. Cynthia Copeland is a member.
We have decided that we're fed up with these high-stakes tests that are being distributed to our children, and that they are trying to make compulsory examinations, and we just don't feel that we want to take part in anything that has such high stakes, meaning that so much is connected to graduation rates and promotion and teacher salary and school closings and school report card grades, teacher evaluations. These are things that we are just really sick and tired of, and we feel that this is not learning that is going to help our children get into any college.
And, of course, a curriculum that is based around teaching for the test.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of instances where test preparation has become overwhelmingly the methods and approaches for children to learn during the day. And this has been going on in some schools in the city since right after the winter break. In some instances, it's been shortly thereafter, but it's this constant teaching to the test so that, again, these high stakes that are affiliated with it, children are at the mercy of these individuals who are making these demands, and there's no real learning going on.
Well, how are other parents responding? I'm sure that some are reluctant to go heads up against the school authorities.
That is true. There are a number of parents and families, this issue has weighed heavily on their hearts. And so many people are concerned about the possibility of some sort of punishments, that this will be considered an action that deserves to be punished. And so there's been this atmosphere of fear and intimidation that has definitely revealed itself. And so in those instances where parents are kind of concerned and afraid to take a stand for their children and advocate for their families, they're choosing to just go along with the program. Other people are coming to this boycott for various reasons. Some people, they feel that there's a lot of stress and it's making their children sick, and that is definitely part of it. But the majority of us are in it because, again, we feel that there is too much riding on these exams that have so much to do with the dismantling of the public school system, which so many of us, this is the only option we have for our children to learn. And we believe that it is we still believe in the public school system. We know it can be a good thing for people. It is the closest thing we have to an equitable system for education, although that is even questionable. But if we don't fight for it to stop the dismantling of it, it will be dismantled.
Are you getting any encouragement from teachers, either teachers as individuals or from the union?
Well, that's a dicey kind of conversation. There are teachers out there who are speaking in their own areas, in their own silos. And the short answer is yes, but how it's done, you've got to be careful. We have to defend and protect these teachers because they don't have a voice. They, too, have been silenced, and they, too, are part of this atmosphere of fear and intimidation, and their jobs could be on the line. They may personally believe that it's not a good thing. In some instances, teachers are parents, too, and they know that this is not the right thing to do. So certainly there are conversations that are going on, but in terms of taking action, it's not an easy place for teachers to be to take action.
Lots of suburban jurisdictions around the country have been resisting this high-stakes testing under No Child Left Behind for a long time.
That is so true, and I have to say, we are not the first to join this. The first boycott in New York State comes from the independent schools, the private schools. They knew this wasn't a good thing, and their children do not take these exams. They're not subjected to this. They haven't been. And so we feel that if it's good enough for them, then we need to jump on that bandwagon, although however late it is, we need to be there too.
There seems to be a consensus among those who claim to be school reformers that high-stakes testing is even more vital in inner-city schools than in those suburban districts.
Yeah, there seems to be that consensus. And the way the parents are looking at that is that that's a great way to create a tool to close schools in neighborhoods that have never had the supports ever that they should have had. They've never had equitable opportunities for their children. They never have the resources that other communities and neighborhoods have had. And so we see this as just truly malpractice. It's like child abuse, really, It's not fair when children don't have any kind of real, the scaffolding for learning hasn't been there, and then you turn around and you're going to provide them with tests that are above the levels where they are age appropriately, grade appropriately, and in terms of what they have been able to access within their lives. If you create the illusion that there is a serious problem out there, then you can come in on your white horse and come in and say we can save the day by creating these examinations and claim that you're going to fix it. And so that's really kind of what this is about. It's about creating an illusion of hysteria, because even our chancellor and our chief academic officer say that the kids are not going, they're not expecting these kids to pass this exam this year. They expect them to do poorly on this year's tests. And why would you put children through this kind of rigorous, constant test prep and then have them take these exams when you are not expecting them to pass?
Which is why many maintain that high-stakes testing is just a pretext for school closings and charterization.
That's our belief, and that's what the parents are starting to realize, and it's slow and coming. But people are starting to realize that, and we just say no more. We're fed up, and we really want to change the stakes. We want to change the stakes, and we want to influence policy. And, you know, oftentimes in communities where families are able to work with schools, it's the situation where the parents' association can raise enough money to offer supplies. We've got to buy the supplies for the school. Teachers need copy paper for the copying machine, and teachers need pencils, and so everybody is bringing in, at the beginning of the year, we're bringing in hand sanitizers, the whole list that comes. Parents are very important at that point, but we're not important enough to be brought to the table to have a discussion as to how our children are going to be educated. They don't want to hear our voices when we say, Stratine, these tests don't work. This is not learning. We want real-world learning experiences. We want project-based learning. We want children to meet historians and scientists, and we want to examine what's going on in the water out there so that we can determine pollutants and so on and so forth. That's real learning. That is college readiness, not coloring circles for bubble tests.
And how might the administration retaliate against this boycott?
We don't know for sure. But it's possible that children will not be promoted. You know, they may take it out on our children. They may take it out on the principals of schools. They may hold back whatever funding is available, cut down on budgets. There's a host of things that they could do. We don't know. But it's not doing and finding out what they plan to do is just the worst thing that we can do, which is why the parents are organizing and mobilizing. We have more at stake by not acting at this point. We just believe that these high-stakes tests just rob children of their childhood. They're not able to learn. They're not able to be children, particularly in these younger years, the middle childhood years from ages 6 to 11 or thereabouts. These children, their minds are at their open, they're at their peaks for learning. This is a time where all kinds of suggestions for learning and understanding about multiple perspectives and thinking, critical thinking, is there. They're not so rigid. They're learning how to be a little bit more focused in their thinking and understanding. Yet at the same time, they're still, their brains are still, there's a high level of plasticity, and they're able to really consider things. It's the period of consideration, and it's the period of exploration, and it's the period of creativity and thinking and debate. And all of these things are being removed, and we want these opportunities for all children, every child in this city, in this state, in this country, to be able to have that back and not be robbed of understanding what learning and having a joy for learning. We're also very concerned about how these tests will affect our most underserved children, children who are learning disabled, children who are English language learners. This core curriculum that has been created and or is being created, because it hasn't even really been created and tested, again, no real empirical evidence to say that this is going to create a pathway towards success and college readiness. So we want to see this kind of reform. If it has to come from the parents, we're our children's best advocate, and it takes a real village. And I think that people, again, families are starting to realize that there's power in parents. Without parents and children, there'd be no schools and teachers. So we're now starting to realize that we owe it to our kids, we owe it to future generations, and this is why we are finally waking up, so that no child can be robbed of real education anymore.
Cynthia Copeland, a public school parent in New York City. President Obama isn't often the target of protests in Black America, but his proposed cuts in Social Security and other entitlement programs prompted the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey, to take to the streets. Larry Hamm is POP's chairman.
Well, I have to say that, as you know, POP is a Democratic organization, so before we take action, we usually discuss these issues, and I have to say, this was one issue when there wasn't a whole lot of discussion about whether or not we should have a demonstration around Social Security. It was like total unanimity that we should do this. We opted to actually go to the Social Security Administration office in the hood. We had people lined up on either side of the street facing the traffic so that they could read our signs and show their support. And it was really interesting because people literally would walk out of the building. They'd come up to me, "Where can I get one of these signs?" One lady got the sign. Now I'm on the mic. She's standing right next to me. She's saying, "Yes, we need our benefits." So people understand the value of Social Security. And a lot of people are dependent upon Social Security. It's not just senior citizens, disabled folks. There are a lot of children that receive Social Security benefits because their parents are deceased or disabled. There are all kind of folks that receive Social Security benefits. So this is one program for which there is wide, wide support. And the other thing that I found as a result of our demonstration and interacting with people is that a lot of people did not know that Social Security was under attack. A lot of people still don't know that there are folks who want to privatize Social Security. And quite frankly, I think the change in the CPI formula really has gotten by a lot of people, because there are politicians who will say, "Well, we're not going to cut Social Security, but what they're going to change is the price index to which cost of living increases to Social Security are tied." And the result of this change in the CPI is actually going to result in the loss of some hundreds of dollars to people in their benefits. People don't know that. And so we found that there was a lot of folks who didn't know that Social Security was under attack. And I think the more we do to make people aware, the stronger the fight back will be.
And in fact, Black folks are more dependent on Social Security than other groups, as studies have shown. But were people shocked to learn from which quarter the attack is coming from the White House?
Well, we were not shy about saying to people that they needed to call the president and the Congress. We didn't just say the Congress. We didn't just say the right-wingers in Congress. We told people to call their U.S. senators for New Jersey, Lauenberg, Menendez, to call their congressmen, and we told people to call the president, because the president has made it clear that quote-unquote entitlement programs are not sacred cows to his administration, and they are on the table. And that's very unfortunate, because that has made President Obama the first Democratic president to actually propose cuts to Social Security. I mean, that's one of the things that the Democratic Party is known for, Social Security. You know, President Roosevelt came under very heavy criticism and attack for proposing the idea of Social Security, because the Republicans at that time, the 1930s, were saying that Social Security would make people not want to work, make people lazy, make people irresponsible, that people should take care of their own family members when they get old and aged and disabled. And there was a lot of resistance to Social Security in the early 1930s. One of the ironies of it is, you mentioned the Black community, is that many African Americans were in fact excluded from the New Deal. The categories of jobs that African Americans would work, such as agricultural workers, domestic workers, during the 20s and 30s, a lot of African Americans were agricultural domestic workers. They were ineligible for Social Security. So this is a benefit that came to the Black community years after the the white community had availed themselves of it. And the irony is now is that African Americans, because we have higher rates of disability and illness in our community and death rates in our community, we are even more dependent upon Social Security. So I think in our community, people are well aware of how important the program is. I think a lot of people were unaware that, in fact, President Obama has taken a position that he would be open to certain changes in Social Security.
I know that after so many decades of righteous demonstrations, the members of the People's Organization for Progress aren't shocked by much, but was your membership shocked at this assault?
No, our membership wasn't shocked because we're an organization that talks about politics. I mean, first of all, we're an organization that meets more than most grassroots volunteer organizations in the black community. There are very few organizations that can say they meet every week. We meet every Thursday. Our General Assembly, which is the governing group of the whole People's Organization for Progress statewide, we meet on a weekly basis. And as you know, we've had some pretty intense debates about President Obama. I know some people might find it interesting that, in fact, the People's Organization for Progress did finally come to endorse President Obama in both elections after much discussion and debate. And the reason we have these debates is because of situations like this. I mean, when you're trying to make a serious decision about something, you have to make a serious assessment of all the conditions. And here we are after repudiating the extreme right-wing frontal attack with former Governor Romney as the presidential candidate. We beat that back, and everybody knows that he was for cuts in various what they call entitlement programs. And then we turn around after Romney has been repelled, then we turn around and we have to fight the very guy that we said we would vote for over Romney. But we have to do that. We have to do what we have to do. President Obama is going to do what he thinks he has to do for himself and his party. And the People's Organization for Progress, we have to do what we think is best for our communities that we live in, our membership, and the constituencies that we say we are fighting for. That's working and poor people, African Americans, and other people of color, in essence, the masses of the people. And cuts in Social Security are a direct attack on the interests of the constituencies we are trying to fight for, on the elderly, on the disabled, on children. And I guess some people can remain silent on the issue, but we can't. So we try to see things realistically, try to see things for what they are. Even though we went for President Obama over Romney, we can't sit idly by and let the social safety net be deconstructed.
Larry Hamm, speaking from Newark, New Jersey. In Columbia, South Carolina, writer and activist Kevin Alexander Gray is not surprised in the least that President Obama has targeted Social Security.
From the start, Obama has been leading the charge to betray Social Security and the idea of the safety net and the foundation of the Democratic Party's policy platform, which is the New Deal. I've been telling folk who say that Obama is betraying them or betraying the legacy of FDR that you have to believe in something before you can betray it. And from the start with the Simpson-Bowles Commission, where they were talking about raising the retirement age to 69 when the average lifespan of a black man is 67, that ought to tell you that Obama is willing to negotiate with your not being around or negotiate how long you work and give that away from the start. So even with the premise that Social Security is in trouble, when the Social Security Trust Fund is solvent, it's just that the funds are being used to pay for the wars, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, of which Obama continues to prosecute, in which innocent civilians are killed daily. That's the big lie. The big lie is that Social Security is in trouble anyway. What always just troubles me about Obama supporters, and in particular black Obama supporters, when you look at things like Social Security and whether or not it's solvent and how it will affect them in the future. They just seem to ignore it just for the idea that we have to support this particular black president. No policy demands, no political demands. It's just all about misguided racial pride.
The math tells us that there could be no successful assault on Social Security unless it was led by this president. The Republicans don't have the votes to do that on their own, and they were beaten the last time they tried to weaken or privatize Social Security under Bush.
Listen, if you consider that Obama came in, signed off on the TARPs, signed off on Too Big to Fail, saved the banks, didn't prosecute any of the banksters. He's talking about privatizing public education. He's supporting the charter schools. You've got black Obama supporters in Chicago that supported Rahm Emanuel, that's supporting this Arne Duncan takeover or paradigm shift of what the public schools are, taking us back to the point where we're going to have a school system based on classism and elitism. I mean, Obama is a friend of Wall Street. He's a friend of privatization. He is the face of the capitalist empire. That's what he believes in.
But so many black folks told us that, well, Obama in his second term won't have to face re-election again, and then we'll see the true Obama.
Obama lost out. If he ever was a liberal Democrat wanting to preserve certain liberal Democratic values, if he were a liberal Democrat wanting to take on the excesses of the Bush administration, if he wanted to make significant changes in health care instead of this privatization of health care called Obamacare, if he really wanted to do something like universal health care, if he wanted to do something on guns, which I don't know if I agree with him, but if he, whatever he wanted to do, he would have had to do it in those first 2 years. And then he would have had to fight to make sure in that midterm election and in his reelection that there were Democrats that supported a so-called liberal Democratic agenda in Congress. It was all about getting Obama reelected. It wasn't about what was going on the local level. It wasn't about all this gerrymandering that was taking place all across the South in these Republican districts. There's never been anything except reelect this president and let's play this symbolism of American post-racialism. No policy content. Meanwhile, you know, the unemployment numbers for the black community in particular have been going up and up and up and up, up and up and up and up. It's a depression in the black community. And all we are getting is an increased police presence in the black community. And folk believing that it's their fault that they are poor. It's their fault that they can't get a job. No, they don't have to call you a nigger anymore, as Eddie Griffin, the comedian, says. They can just tell you, I'm sorry, we don't have any jobs. So it's pretty awful that Obama has come in to office and he's been nothing more than a corporate shill and a celebrity, and people buy into that. And it's sad that the level of politics in this country and the black community has been reduced to where people are reading about Jay-Z going to Cuba. He's talking about communism and what's wrong with communism on his trip to Cuba, but when someone says something about Occupy, he's quick to praise capitalism and his role in it. So people are just really confused about how we got to where we are. What is leadership? Are we trying to change the system or are we just trying to run the system?
You say people are confused. People would certainly naturally be confused if they don't have leadership.
You can't just blame that on Obama. If you go look at the NAACP, the Urban League, or any of the organizations that have been around a long time, they've been problematic for a long time, but nothing has emerged to replace them. The other myth that people like to paint is that the black church has led the movement in any regard. There have been some ministers, but the church, the black church, like the white church, moves to protect itself. It's not necessarily concerned about what happens external to the church. They're concerned about whether or not they're going to build and build and build and maintain Jesus, Inc. That's their job. We haven't built any kind of independent bodies to educate people politically and to challenge government when need be, to challenge elected officials when need be, to educate people about things like redistricting, to teach people about their constitutional rights so that stop and frisk doesn't become the law of the land, especially in light of a history of the black codes and the slave codes and loitering laws and vagrancy laws and why we fight to keep those laws off the books. That's the thing that's missing. Now it's acceptable, as you see it on the social media all the time. We ought to pass laws to keep young black men from wearing saggy pants, like they're not going to grow out of it. So you criminalize that, and you give the police another reason to stop people instead of trying to figure out what conditions can you change around people to help them have some self-esteem, if that's what you want to call it. Because in some of this stuff with these kids, they're just doing it because they're kids and they rebel, and kids rebel against older people. That's always been the way. But to criminalize it and to focus that criminalization on young black kids, and then look at the war on drugs. I mean, we got all these police, just as we've seen in Boston. They respond to a crisis in full battle gear. And when they're not responding to a crisis in full battle gear, they're out in the neighborhoods in full battle gear and in full nigger catching Jones mode, stop and frisk, racial profiling, the war on drugs, filling up the prison industrial complex so that Obama and his friends who support privatization and buying and selling prisons on Wall Street get paid. We got to mount something against that.
Attorney General Eric Holder said earlier this month at a talk to Al Sharpton's group, the National Action Network, that he was surprised to find that there were racial disparities in prosecution and in sentencing of folks.
Either he is looking for a way out of his job because he's tired of the hypocrisy, so he's just saying imbecilic, nonsensical things, or he's on drugs. Can't be but one or the other. He's at the Justice Department. He knows what the figures say in regards to who's in jail and why they're in jail. The Justice Department has racial profiling initiatives. To say in a country that's profoundly racist that, oh, I didn't know that this type of racism existed, when you're the organization that's responsible for investigating and prosecuting, when you're asking people to help preserve the Voting Rights Act, when you're challenging voter ID laws, when you look at the rise in hate crimes, when you look at the number of people who are killed by police violence, who are they? Are they black? Are they white? Are they brown? It's just an imbecilic statement to make.
And Holder spoke to a NAND convention, Al Sharpton's group's convention, and they seemed to be happy to have him.
Well, but then you got to consider where the meeting, and it's NAND, and it's Sharpton, and it's history. And, you know, the White House and the government ought to just go ahead and give Al Sharpton a job straight up. Just give him a job. Say he works for the government. Give him a job at the Justice Department or the FBI, the police, or wherever, a Radio for America. Give him that job so that he can be officially with government instead of unofficially with government.
The Congressional Black Caucus calls itself the conscience of the Congress. Do you think that they will conscientiously stand up to this assault on Social Security?
There is some organizing that needs to be done beyond the Black Caucus, beyond press conferences, beyond sending out statements to your constituency via e-blast or maybe coming to a town hall meeting every couple of months and saying how you fight the good fight. There has to be some real serious organizing that happens. If you're really serious about changing the politics in this country, it has to be a grassroots effort and has to be focused in the South because this is where the fight is. This is where, even if you're talking about, I wouldn't support a lot of neoliberal policy proposals because they're nothing more than the other side of a bad coin of imperialism and capitalism. But if you're really talking about seriously organizing, you have to figure out a way to get from behind the computer, from behind the TV screen, and the movement has to be material instead of virtual. We have to figure out a way to put pressure on people where they live. Anger can't be episodic, in which people go from the latest tragedy to the next tragedy on TV, and that's all they're talking and tweeting about. Even if they want to take on the NRA, as they say, and this idea of gun control, well, you sure better be talking about it in a way that people really understand what it is that you're trying to do. And you really want to talk about the police state. When you talk about taking away guns and social order, then you can't exclude the police from that conversation and police practices. You can't exclude the idea that we're a culture of violence. And how do you curb some of that violence? Those are all things that are not episodic kinds of conversations. That's about grassroots organizing and public education in a different kind of way, a movement. And it can't be a fake movement where people go and get arrested on cue at the White House and get their picture taken and then go make the rounds of the TV networks. It's got to be something deeper than that, and that's not what's being done. As far as the Black Caucus is concerned, at the end of the day, they're still Democrats, and they'll fall in line. I wish they wouldn't, because this attack on Social Security and the just sad way it comes at Black people, to where you work until you die, you can't expect to collect retirement. Retirement that you accumulate in your life goes to pay for the wars, and the only way your kids can benefit is if they go and kill somebody else's kids, or fathers, or mothers. That's the cycle that we have to break, and that's what the Black Caucus ought to be standing up to. And so when three people get killed in Boston and hundreds more injured, we got to know that, you know, if you really want a less violent world, what happens here, it also matters what happens to people in other lands that is done at our hands. All of it matters. I hope the Black Caucus becomes something more than just an appendage of white power. I'm hoping for that. I think the jury's still out on it.
Kevin Alexander Gray is author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission claims that the federal government's sequestration cuts will drastically increase the agency's backlog of cases. But Ricardo Jones, the EEOC's former chief investigator for the Southern District of New York, says that's just another excuse for the commission to dismiss Black people's complaints of discrimination.
The reality here is the union, the AFG of the EEOC, is in cahoots with the role managers of the EEOC. Gabrielle Martin, who is a Black attorney who works out of the Phoenix office of the EEOC, basically is like any other corrupt union official. She has a no-show job. She doesn't really have to do anything. And basically, she has control of the union. And basically, she's doing the bidding of the EEOC, the management of the EEOC, which is Jacqueline Barron's and the other commissioners. So they're not even protecting the rights of the EEOC employee. Jacqueline Barron's came into the EEOC, and she was told by Senator Tom Harkin, when she was trying to be confirmed and she got a recess appointment, that he wanted the backlog taken care of. Well, that's a code. Now, Trent Locke was forced out of the Senate because he used coding. Well, Tom Harkin used coding, too. Getting rid of the backlog at the EEOC means getting rid of dismissing Black complaints. So Jacqueline Barron's basically put out a memorandum to all investigators that she wanted an additional 50 complaints dismissed per investigator across this country. Now, when you say dismiss 50 additional complaints, the average investigator is dismissing somewhere between 100 and 150 complaints per year. So add 50 to that, that's 200. Well, they did it. Now, the AFGE, the union, Gabrielle Martin, complained that she didn't give the employees, the investigators, enough time to dismiss those complaints because she put that memo out in the fourth quarter of the fiscal year. And there's a ULP, an unfair labor practice complaint filed with the Federal Labor Administration against the EEOC for trying to force the investigator to dismiss an additional 50 Black complaints, because that's what it really is.
Now, the EEOC has, I believe, about 1,000 investigators, so an additional 50 complaints dismissed a year would be 50,000 mostly Black complaints dismissed per year.
Exactly, Glenn, and that's what happened. And once she dismissed those 50 additional complaints, if you don't do that as an investigator, you'll be disciplined. You end up like Ricardo Jones. See, I'm the scapegoat. I'm the prime example that they use. I'm the bad slave. I'm Nat Turner, see? And then they just took me out, and they hung me upside down, and they put me on the bottom of my feet in front of all the other slaves. So the other slaves on the plantation say that, hey, I don't want to end up like Ricardo Jones. because if I have morals and values and go by ethics, then this is what will happen to you. So 50,000 additional African-American complaints were dismissed, and that was it. And she got confirmed. The problem is, why are our people so naive to believe that black people are not bad, that the administration is not a bad administration, when they allow the black unemployment rate to reach 14%? And doing that allows the white unemployment rate to drop to 6%. Full employment in this country is 4%. They're 2 percentage points away from full employment. Now, they're not creating new jobs. There are no new jobs. No new jobs at all. I don't care what they say. All they're doing is firing black people and replacing them with white people. Now, this is not rocket science, but this is being done. And the thing that's hard for everyone to accept in our community is it's being done by blacks on other blacks.
So what you seem to be saying is that the union and the EEOC's management's contention that the backlog will increase because of sequestration, well, actually, that will just be another excuse to dismiss more black complaints at the EEOC and blame it on lack of funds.
Well, you know, why should the president said that with union management standing next to him, why would he miss an opportunity to basically undermine the black working community? Why should he miss that? Why shouldn't he use this opportunity? The sequester really doesn't affect white people as much as it affects us. The people who are going to be furloughed are not going to be white people. If white management has to pick who's going to be furloughed, who do you think they will furlough? Do you think they'll furlough their own people? No. We're very naive in this assumption that we're trying to make here, that the president is not for the status quo white. Look at the unemployment rate. 6% for them. Full employment is 4%. Our unemployment rate is between 16 and 14%. Now, how is he getting their unemployment rate down by making our unemployment rate go up? That's the game that he's playing. And whites will not complain about that because their people are full employed and they're 2 percentage points away from full employment. The sequester, you know, that's a joke. He just saw an opportunity. Never take a tragedy, never take a bad situation and not turn it. He learned that from Richard Daley. He is the product of the Daley administration in Chicago, both him and his wife. This, you just don't miss an opportunity like this. So many people think because he's African-American or he looks black and his wife is black and African-American that they would not do black people wrong. Well, that's naive to say that. Look at the statistics. Look at the unemployment rates. Look at the EEOC. Why did he appoint his wife's girlfriend to be in charge of the rogue EEOC?
So I believe that what you've been saying is that the EEOC, which has been excessively dismissing black complaints all along, will just take this sequestration as an excuse to continue doing the same.
They have a budget for overtime. They haven't paid any overtime to any investigator, any mediator at the EEOC for the past 15 years. 15 years. So the question is, what are they doing with that money that they've been budgeted for to deal with the backlog? The backlog is a figment of their imagination. It's a figment of the people in our community's imaginations, because even if they dealt with the backlog, they'll only dismiss it anyway. I mean, they only find reasonable cause 3.1% of the time. I mean, that's even worse than the Bush administration. But the reality is, if you're trying to perpetrate that there is no more race discrimination in the United States of America as far as employment is concerned, we need to look at their data, not the numbers that they put out. The numbers that they put out are bad, and it's not any better in any other areas that they're investigating also. First off, they're not doing investigations. There are no investigations being done by Chai Feldenblum, the commissioner at the EEOC, is advertising publicly about cases where you have Muslim lawyers that are going after Muslim discrimination. Well, that means that the Muslim lawyers or the Indian lawyers at the EEOC only investigate and only litigate Indian cases. That means the lawyers that they have at the EEOC only go after people that have similarities to themselves. The white lawyers help white people. The Asian lawyers help Asian people. The black lawyers don't help anybody because they're afraid to do that.
The Detroit City Council voted 5-2 to approve giving the right-wing law firm Jones Day the contract to represent the city's interests, even as several dozen protesters registered their disgust at the arrangement before police cleared the chambers. Two council members made themselves absent from the vote. Jones Day is the same law firm in which Kevin Orr, Detroit's state-appointed emergency manager, was a partner before Michigan's governor made him dictator of Detroit. Which means that Orr, a bankruptcy lawyer who will have the power to dispose of the city's assets, property, and contracts, will work directly with his old firm. Meanwhile, Jones Day already represents a number of banks that are at opposite ends of derivative deals with Detroit involving hundreds of millions of dollars. Jones Day and its supporters on the council claim they see no conflict of interest. Even a blind person can see that this is not right, said Charles Williams Sr., a protester and member of the National Action Network. It was Detroit's pro-business mayor, Dave Bing, who pushed for Jones Day to get the contract in the first place. Based on the powers that emergency manager Kevin Orr claims to have, it would not have mattered if the council had voted against Jones Day, or could simply have overridden them. So why did the council do it? That's a question that goes beyond the current assault on democracy in Detroit. The former Motor City is no different than the rest of Black America, where a venal, self-centered Black misleadership class holds the rest of African America in utter contempt. They grovel before power, hoping only that some of the crumbs will fall their way. Service to the people is an alien concept to this crowd, whether in Atlanta or D.C. or Detroit. If they were more competent, they would be even more corrupt, but as often as not, they fail even to enrich themselves and succeed only in impoverishing and embarrassing us all. Kevin Orr understood that all he had to do to keep the majority of the city council in check was allow them to continue receiving their salaries, which by law had been reduced to zero and could have been kept there at Orr's pleasure. Mayor Bing, the corporate water boy, had already proposed in his budget that each council person be reduced to one staff member. Certainly not enough to keep track of the machinations of Kevin Orr and his friends and former colleagues at Jones Day, who will surely feast on the bones of Detroit. However, even in their impotence, the groveling council majority have managed to inflict more injury on Detroit. By approving the Jones Day contract, the majority has certainly weakened any legal challenges to the disenfranchisement of Detroit's people. Even though their vote was not necessary, the council majority have endorsed the machinery of Detroit's disempowerment. It will be argued that the people's representatives have effectively given thumbs up to the nullification of Detroit, which has ceased to exist as a real city except as debtor and prey to the bankers. The Black misleadership class cannot and will not defend Black people. In the end, they can't even defend themselves. And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.